was looking at the dreamer. "Morel," said the Count to him at length, "do you repent having followed me?"
"No, Count, but to leave Paris, if I thought happiness might await you in Paris, Morel, I would have left you there. Valentine reposes within the walls of Paris, and to leave Paris is like losing her a second time."
"Maximilian," said the Count, "the friends that we have lost do not repose in the bosom of the earth, but are buried deep in our hearts, and it has been thus ordained that we may always be accompanied by them. I have two friends who, in this way, never depart from me, the one who gave me being, and the other who conferred knowledge and intelligence on me. Their spirits live in me. Listen to the voice of your heart, Morel, and ask it whether you ought to preserve this melancholy exterior towards me."
"My friend," said Maximilian, "the voice of my heart is very sorrowful, and points out the future in most unhappy colours. It is ever thus that weakened minds see everything as through a black veil. The soul forms its own horizons. Your soul is darkened, and consequently the sky of the future appears stormy and unpromising."
"That may possibly be true," said Maximilian, and he again subsided into his thoughtful mood. The journey was performed with that marvellous rapidity which the unlimited power of the Count ever commanded. The following morning they arrived at Chalons, where the Count's steamboat waited for them. Without an instant being lost, the carriage was placed on board, and the two travellers embarked without delay. The boat was built for speed. Her two paddle wheels resembled two wings with which she skimmed the water like a bird. Morel was not insensible to that sensation of delight which is generally experienced in passing rapidly through the air, and the wind, which occasionally raised the hair from his forehead, seemed on the point of dispelling momentarily the clouds collected there. As the distance increased between the travellers and Paris, an almost superhuman serenity appeared to surround the Count. He might have been taken for an exile about to revisit his native land. Ere long, Marseille presented herself to view. With one accord they stopped on the Canebière. A vessel was setting sail for Algiers, on board of which the bustle usually attending departure prevailed. The passengers and their relations crowded on the deck, friends taking a tender but sorrowful leave of each other, some weeping, others noisy in their grief, formed a spectacle exciting even to those who witnessed similar ones daily, but which had not the power to disturb the current of thought that had taken possession of the mind of Maximilian from the moment he had set foot on the broad pavement of the quay.
"Here," said he, leaning heavily on the arm of Monte Cristo, "here is the spot where my father stopped when the Pharaon entered the port. It was here that the good old man, whom you saved from death and dishonour, threw himself into my arms. I yet feel his warm tears on my face, and his were not the only tears shed, for many who witnessed our meeting wept also." Monte Cristo gently smiled and said, "I was there," at the same time pointing to the corner of a street. As he spoke, and in the very direction he indicated, a groan expressive of bitter grief was heard, and a woman was seen waving her hand to a passenger on board the vessel about to sail. Monte Cristo looked at her with an emotion that must have been remarked by Morel had not his eyes been fixed on the vessel.
"Oh, heavens!" exclaimed Morel. "I do not deceive myself. That young man who is waving his hat, that youth in the uniform of a lieutenant, is Albert de Morcerf."
"Yes," said Monte Cristo, "I recognized him."
"How so? You were looking the other way."
The Count smiled, as he was in the habit of doing when he did not wish to make any reply, and he again turned his looks towards the veiled female, who soon disappeared at the corner of the street. Turning to his friend, "Dear Maximilian," said the Count, "have you nothing to do in this land?"
"I have to weep over the grave of my father," replied Morel in a broken voice.
"Well then, go. Wait for me there, and I will soon join you. I have a pious visit to pay." Morel allowed his hand to fall into that which the Count extended to him.
Then, with an inexpressibly melancholy inclination of the head, he quitted the Count and bent his steps to the east of the city. Monte Cristo remained on the same spot until Maximilian was out of sight. He then walked slowly towards the Allée de Meilhan to seek out a small house with which our readers must have been familiar at the commencement of this story. It yet stood under the shade of the fine avenue of lime trees, which forms one of the most frequented walks of the idlers of Marseille, covered by an immense vine which spread its aged and blackened branches over the stone front, burnt yellow by the ardent sun of the south. Two stone steps, worn away by the friction of the feet, led to the door made of three planks, which, owing to their never having made acquaintance with paint or varnish, parted annually to reunite again when the damp season arrived. This house, with all its crumbling antiquity and apparent misery, was yet cheerful and picturesque, and was the same that old Dantès formerly inhabited, the only difference being that the old man occupied merely the garret, while the whole house was now placed at the command of Mercedes by the Count. A female whom the Count had seen leave the ship with so much regret entered this house. She had scarcely closed the door after her when Monte Cristo appeared at the corner of a street, so that he found and lost her again almost at the same instant. The worn-out steps were old acquaintances of his. He knew better than anyone else how to open that weather-beaten door with a large-headed nail which served to raise the latch within. He entered without knocking or giving any other intimation of his presence, as if he had been the friend or the master of the place. At the end of a passage paved with bricks was seen a little garden bathed in sunshine and rich in warmth and light. It was in this garden that Mercedes found, in the place indicated by the Count, the sum of money which he, through a sense of delicacy, intimated had been placed there 24 years previously. The trees of the garden were easily seen from the steps of the street door. Monte Cristo, on stepping into the house, heard a sigh almost resembling a deep sob. He looked in the direction whence it came, and there, under an arbour of Virginian jessamine, with its thick foliage and beautiful long purple flowers, he perceived Mercedes seated, with her head bowed, and weeping bitterly. She had raised her veil, and with her face hidden by her hands, was giving free scope to those sighs and tears which had been so long restrained by the presence of her son. Monte Cristo advanced a few paces, which were heard on the gravel. Mercedes raised her head and uttered a cry of terror on beholding a man before her. "Madame," said the Count, "it is no longer in my power to restore you to happiness, but I offer you consolation. Will you deign to accept it as coming from a friend?" "I am indeed most wretched," replied Mercedes. "Alone in the world, I had but my son, and he has left me."
"He possesses a noble heart, Madame," replied the Count, "and he has acted rightly. He feels that every man owes a tribute to his country. Had he remained with you, his life must have become a hateful burden, nor would he have participated in your griefs. He will increase in strength and honour by struggling with adversity, which he will convert into prosperity. Leave him to build up the future for you, and I venture to say, you will confide it to safe hands."
"Oh," replied the wretched woman, mournfully shaking her head, "the prosperity of which you speak, and which, from the bottom of my heart, I pray God in his mercy to grant him, I can never enjoy. The bitter cup of adversity has been drained by me to the very dregs, and I feel that the grave is not far distant. You have acted kindly, Count, in bringing me back to the place where I have enjoyed so much bliss. I ought to meet death on the same spot where happiness was once all my own."
"Alas," said Monte Cristo, "your words sear and embitter my heart, the more so as you have every reason to hate me. I have been the cause of all your misfortunes. But why do you pity instead of blame me? You render me still more unhappy."
"Hate you? Blame you? You, Edmund, hate, reproach the man that has spared my son's life?
for was it not your fatal and sanguinary intention to destroy that son of whom Monsieur de Morcerf was so proud? Oh, look at me well, and discover, if you can, even the semblance of a reproach in me."
The Count looked up and fixed his eyes on Mercedes, who, partly rising from her seat, extended both her hands towards him.
"Oh, look at me," continued she with a feeling of profound melancholy. "My eyes no longer dazzle by their brilliancy, for the time has long fled since I used to smile on Edmond Dantès, who anxiously looked out for me from the window of yonder garret, then inhabited by his old father. Years of grief have created an abyss between those days and the present. I neither reproach you nor hate you, my friend. Oh, no, Edmond, it is myself that I blame, myself that I hate. Oh, miserable creature that I am," cried she, clasping her hands and raising her eyes to heaven. "I once possessed piety, innocence, and love, the three ingredients of the happiness of angels. And now what am I?"
Monte Cristo approached her and silently took her hand.
"No," said she, withdrawing it gently. "No, my friend, touch me not. You have spared me, yet of all those who have fallen under your vengeance, I was the most guilty. They were influenced by hatred, by avarice, and by self-love, but I was base and, for want of courage, acted against my judgment. Nay, do not press my hand, Edmond. You are thinking of some kind expression, I am sure, to console me, but do not bestow it on me, for I am no longer worthy of kindness. See," and she exposed her face completely to view, "see, misfortune has silvered my hair. My eyes have shed so many tears that they are encircled by a rim of purple, and my brow is wrinkled. You, Edmond, on the contrary, you are still young, handsome, dignified. It is because you have never doubted the mercy of God, and He has supported and strengthened you in all your trials."
As Mercedes spoke, the tears chased each other down her wan cheeks. The unhappy woman's heart was breaking as memory recalled the changeful events of her life. Monte Cristo, however, took her hand and imprinted a kiss on it, but she herself felt that it was with no greater warmth than he would have respectfully bestowed on the hand of some marble statue of a saint.
"It often happens," continued she, "that a first fault destroys the prospects of a whole life. I believed you dead. Why did I survive you? What good has it done me to mourn for you eternally in the secret recesses of my heart, only to make a woman of 39 look like one of 50 years of age? Why, having recognized you, and I the only one to do so, why was I able to save my son alone? Ought I not also to have rescued the man that I had accepted for a husband, guilty though he were? Yet I let him die. What do I say? Oh, merciful heavens, was I not accessory to his death, by my supine insensibility, by my contempt for him, not remembering or not willing to remember that it was for my sake he had become a traitor and a perjurer? In what am I benefited by accompanying my son so far, since I now abandon him and allow him to depart alone to the baneful climate of Africa? Oh, I have been base, cowardly, I tell you. I have abjured my affections, and like all renegades, I am of evil omen to those who surround me."
"No, Mercedes," said Monte Cristo, "no. You judge yourself with too much severity. You are a noble-minded woman, and it was your grief that disarmed me. Still, I was but an agent led on by an invisible and offended deity who chose not to withhold the fatal blow that I was destined to hurl. I take that God to witness, at whose feet I have prostrated myself daily for the last 10 years, that I would have sacrificed my life to you, and with my life the projects that were indissolubly linked with it. But, and I say it with some pride, Mercedes, God required me, and I lived. examine the past and the present, and endeavour to pierce futurity, and then say whether I am not a divine instrument. The most dreadful misfortunes, the most frightful sufferings, the abandonment of all those who loved me, the persecution of those who did not know me, formed the trials of my youth. When suddenly, from captivity, solitude, misery, I was restored to light and liberty, and became the possessor of a fortune so brilliant, so unbounded, so unheard of, that I must have been blind, not to be conscious that God had endowed me with it to work out his own great designs. From that time, I viewed this fortune as confided to me for a particular purpose. Not a thought was given to a life which you once, Mercedes, had the power to render blissful. Not one hour of peaceful calm was mine, but I felt myself driven on like an exterminating angel. Like those adventurous captains about to embark on some enterprise full of danger, I laid in my provisions, I loaded my arms, I collected every means of attack and defense. I inured my body to the most violent exercises, my soul to the bitterest trials. I taught my arm to slay, my eyes to behold excruciating sufferings, and my mouth to smile at the most horrid spectacles. From good-natured, confiding, and forgiving, I became revengeful, cunning, and wicked, or rather, immovable as fate. Then I launched out into the path that was opened to me. I overcame every obstacle and reached the goal. But woe to those who met me in my career. Enough, said Mercedes. Enough, Edmund. Believe me that she who alone recognized you has been the only one to comprehend you. And had she crossed your path, and you had crushed her like a frail glass, still, Edmund, still, she must have admired you. Like the gulf between me and the past, there is an abyss between you, Edmund, and the rest of mankind, and I tell you freely that the comparison I drew between you and other men will ever be one of my greatest tortures. No, there is nothing in the world to resemble you in worth and goodness. But we must say farewell, Edmund, and let us part. Before I leave you, Mercedes, have you no request to make? Said the Count. I desire but one thing in this world, Edmund, the happiness of my son. Pray to the Almighty to spare his life, and I will take upon myself to promote his happiness. Thanks, thanks, Edmund. But have you no request to make for yourself, Mercedes? For myself? I want nothing. I live, as it were, between two graves. The one, that of Edmond Dantès, lost to me long, long since. He had my love. That word ill becomes my faded lip now, but it is a memory dear to my heart, and one that I would not lose for all that the world contains. The other grave is that of the man who met his death from the hand of Edmond Dantès. I approve of the deed, but I must pray for the dead. Yes, your son shall be happy, Mercedes, repeated the Count. Then I shall enjoy as much happiness as this world can possibly confer. But what are your intentions? To say that I shall live here, like the Mercedes of other times, gaining my bread by labor, would not be true, nor would you believe me. I have no longer the strength to do anything but to spend my days in prayer. However, I shall have no occasion to work, for the little sum of money buried by you, and which I found in the place you mentioned, will be sufficient to maintain me. Rumor will probably be busy respecting me, my occupations, my manner of living. That will signify but little. Mercedes, said the Count, I do not say it to blame you, but you made an unnecessary sacrifice in relinquishing the whole of the fortune amassed by Monsieur de Morcerf. Half of it, at least, by right belonged to you, in virtue of your vigilance and economy. I perceive what you are intending to propose to me, but I cannot accept it, Edmund. My son would not permit it. Nothing shall be done without the full approbation of Albert de Morcerf. I will make myself acquainted with his intentions, and will submit to them. But if he be willing to accept my offers, will you oppose them? You know well, Edmund, that I am no longer a reasoning creature. I have no will, unless it be the will never to decide.
I have been so overwhelmed by the many storms that have broken over my head that I am become passive in the hands of the Almighty, like a sparrow in the talons of an eagle. I live because it is not ordained for me to die. If succor be sent to me, I will accept it." "Ah, madame," said Monte Cristo, "you should not talk thus. It is not so we should evince our resignation to the will of heaven. On the contrary, we are all free agents." "Alas," exclaimed Mercedes, "if it were so, if I possessed free will, but without the power to render that will efficacious, it would drive me to despair." Monte Cristo dropped his head and shrank from the vehemence of her grief. "Will you not even say you will see me again?" he asked. "On the contrary, we shall meet again," said Mercedes, pointing to heaven with solemnity. "I tell you so to prove to you that I still hope." And after pressing her own trembling hand upon that of the Count, Mercedes rushed up the stairs and disappeared. Monte Cristo slowly left the house and turned towards the quay, but Mercedes saw not his departure, though she was seated at the little window of the room which had been occupied by old Dantès. Her eyes were straining to see the ship which was carrying her son over the vast sea, but still her voice involuntarily murmured softly, "Edmond, Edmond, Edmond." The Count departed with a sad heart from the house in which he had left Mercedes, probably never to behold her again. He turned towards the cemetery, where he felt sure of finding Morel. He, too, 10 years ago, had piously sought out a tomb, and sought it vainly. He, who returned to France with millions, had been unable to find the grave of his father, who had perished from hunger. Morel had indeed placed a cross over the spot, but it had fallen down, and the gravedigger had burnt it, as he did all the old wood in the churchyard. The worthy merchant had been more fortunate. Dying in the arms of his children, he had been by them laid by the side of his wife, who had preceded him in eternity by 2 years. 2 large slabs of marble, on which were inscribed their names, were placed on either side of a little enclosure, railed in and shaded by 4 cypress trees. Morel was leaning against one of these, mechanically fixing his eyes on the graves. His grief was so profound he was nearly unconscious. "Maximilian," said the Count, "you should not look on the graves, but there," and he pointed upwards. "The dead are everywhere," said Morel. "Did you not yourself tell me so as we left Paris?" "Maximilian," said the Count, "you asked me during the journey to allow you to remain some days at Marseille. Do you still wish to do so?"
"I have no wishes, Count, only I fancy I could pass the time less painfully here than anywhere else.
So much the better, for I must leave you. But I carry your word with me, do I not?"
"You have my promise," he said after a minute's pause, extending his hand to Monte Cristo. "Only remember, on the 5th of October, Morel, I shall expect you at the island of Monte Cristo. On the 4th, a yacht will wait for you in the port of Bastia. It will be called the Eurus. You will deliver your name to the captain, who will bring you to me. It is understood, is it not?"
"But, Count, do you remember that the 5th of October, child," replied the Count, "not to know the value of a man's word? I have told you 20 times that if you wish to die on that day, I will assist you. Morel, farewell."
"Do you leave me?"
"Yes, I have business in Italy. I leave you alone with your misfortunes and with hope, Maximilian."
"When do you leave?"
"Immediately. The steamer waits, and in an hour I shall be far from you. Will you accompany me to the harbour, Maximilian?"
"I am entirely yours, Count."
Morel accompanied the Count to the harbour. The white steam was ascending like a plume of feathers from the black chimney. The steamer soon disappeared, and in an hour afterwards, as the Count had said, was scarcely distinguishable in the horizon amidst the fogs of the night.
114. Peppino. At the same time the steamer disappeared behind Cape Morgiou, a man travelling post on the road from Florence to Rome had just passed the little town of Acqua Pendente. He was travelling fast enough to make a good deal of ground, without becoming altogether suspicious. This man, dressed in a greatcoat, or rather a surtout, a little the worse for the journey, but which exhibited the riband of the Légion d'honneur, still fresh and brilliant, a decoration which also ornamented the undercoat, might be recognized not only by these signs, but also from the accent with which he spoke to the postillion, to be a Frenchman. Another proof that he was a native of the universal country was apparent in the fact of his knowing no other Italian words than the terms used in music. Allegro, he called out to the postillions at every ascent. Moderato, he cried as they descended. And anyone who has ever travelled that road knows there are hills enough between Rome and Florence by the way of Acqua Pendente. These two words greatly amused the men to whom they were addressed. On reaching La Storta, the point from whence Rome is first visible, the traveller evinced none of the enthusiastic curiosity which usually leads strangers to stand up and endeavour to catch sight of the dome of St. Peter's, which may be seen long before any other object is distinguishable. No, he merely drew a pocket-book from his pocket, and took from it a paper, folded in four, and, after having examined it in a manner almost reverential, he said, "Good. I have it still." The carriage entered by the Porta del Popolo, turned to the left and stopped at the Hotel d'Espagna. Maitre Pastrini, our old acquaintance, received the traveller at the door, hat in hand. The traveller alighted, ordered a good dinner, and inquired the address of the house of Thompson and French, which was immediately given to him, as it was one of the most celebrated in Rome. It was situated in the Via de' Banchi, near St. Peter's. In Rome, as everywhere else, the arrival of a post-chaise is an event. 10 young descendants of Marius and the Gracchi, barefooted and out at elbows, with one hand resting on the hip and the other arm gracefully curved above the head, stared at the traveller, the post-chaise, and the horses. To these were added about 50 little vagabonds from the States of His Holiness, who made a collection for plunging into the Tiber at high water from the bridge of Sant'Angelo. Now, as these gamins of Rome, more fortunate than those of Paris, understand every language, more especially the French, they heard the traveller order an apartment, a dinner, and finally inquire the way to the house of Thompson and French. The result was that when the newcomer left the hotel with the cicerone, a man detached himself from the rest of the idlers, and, without having been seen by the traveller, and appearing to excite no attention from the guide, followed the stranger with as much skill as a Parisian agent of police would have used. The Frenchman had been so impatient to reach the house of Thompson and French that he would not wait for the horses to be harnessed, but left word for the carriage to overtake him on the road, or to wait for him at the banker's door. He reached it before the carriage arrived. The Frenchman entered, leaving his guide in the anteroom, who immediately entered into conversation with two or three of those industrious idlers who are always to be found in Rome at the doors of banking houses, churches, museums, or theatres. With the Frenchman, the man who had followed him entered too. The Frenchman knocked at the inner door and entered the first room. His shadow did the same.
"Messrs. Thompson and French?" inquired the stranger.
A kind of footman rose at a sign from a confidential clerk belonging to the first desk.
"Whom shall I announce?" said the footman. "The Baron Danglars."
"Follow me," said the man. A door opened, through which the footman and the baron disappeared. The man who had followed Danglars sat down on a bench. The clerk continued to write for the next 5 minutes. The man also preserved profound silence and remained perfectly motionless. Then the pen of the clerk ceased to move over the paper. He raised his head, and, appearing to be perfectly sure of a tête-à-tête, "Aha!" he said. "Here you are, Peppino."
"Yes," was the laconic reply. "You have found out that there is something worth having about this large gentleman?
There is no great merit due to me, for we were informed of it.
You know his business here, then?"
"Pardieu, he has come to draw, but I don't know how much."
"You will know presently, my friend."
"Very well. Only do not give me false information, as you did the other day."
"What do you mean? Of whom do you speak? Was it the Englishman who carried off 3,000 crowns from here the other day?"
"No, he really had 3,000 crowns, and we found them. I mean the Russian prince, who you said had 30,000 livres,
and we only found 22,000. You must have searched badly. Luigi Vampa himself searched.
Indeed. But you must let me make my observations, or the Frenchman will transact his business without my knowing the sum.
Peppino nodded, and taking a rosary from his pocket, began to mutter a few prayers, while the clerk disappeared through the same door by which Danglars and the footman had gone out. At the expiration of 10 minutes, the clerk returned with a bright countenance.
"Well?" asked Peppino of his friend. "Joy, joy! The sum is large.
5 or 6 millions, is it not?"
"Yes. You know the amount."
"On the receipt of the Count of Monte Cristo?"
"Why, how came you to be so well acquainted with all this?"
"I told you, we were informed beforehand."
"Then why do you apply to me?"
"That I may be sure I have the right man."
"Yes, it is indeed he. 5 millions. A pretty sum, eh, Peppino?"
"Hush. Here is our man." The clerk seized his pen and Peppino his beads. One was writing and the other praying when the door opened. Danglars looked radiant with joy. The banker accompanied him to the door. Peppino followed Danglars. According to the arrangements, the carriage was waiting at the door. The guide held the door open. Guides are useful people who will turn their hands to anything. Danglars leaped into the carriage like a young man of 20. The cicerone reclosed the door and sprang up by the side of the coachman. Peppino mounted the seat behind.
"Will Your Excellency visit St. Peter's?" asked the cicerone. "I did not come to Rome to see," said Danglars aloud. Then he added softly, with an avaricious smile, "I came to touch." And he tapped his pocketbook, in which he had just placed a letter. "Then Your Excellency is going to the hotel."
"Casa Pastrini," said the cicerone to the coachman, and the carriage drove rapidly on. 10 minutes afterwards, the Baron entered his apartment, and Peppino stationed himself on the bench outside the door of the hotel. After having whispered something in the ear of one of the descendants of Marius and the Gracchi, whom we noticed at the beginning of the chapter, who immediately ran down the road leading to the capital at his fullest speed. Danglars was tired and sleepy. He therefore went to bed, placing his pocketbook under his pillow. Peppino had a little spare time, so he had a game of mora with the facchina, lost 3 crowns, and then, to console himself, drank a bottle of Vin d'Orvieto. The next morning, Danglars awoke late, though he went to bed so early. He had not slept well for 5 or 6 nights, even if he had slept at all. He breakfasted heartily, and, caring little, as he said, for the beauties of the Eternal City, ordered post-horses at noon. But Danglars had not reckoned upon the formalities of the police and the idleness of the posting-master. The horses only arrived at 2 o'clock, and the cicerone did not bring the passport till 3. All these preparations had collected a number of idlers round the door of Metra Pastrini's. The descendants of Marius and the Gracchi were also not wanting. The Baron walked triumphantly through the crowd, who, for the sake of gain, styled him Your Excellency. As Danglars had hitherto contented himself with being called a baron, he felt rather flattered at the title of Excellency, and distributed 12 pawls amongst the canaille, who were ready for 12 more, to call him Your Highness.
"Which road?" asked the postillion in Italian. "The Ancona Road," replied the baron.
Maitre Pastrini interpreted the question and answer, and the horses galloped off. Danglars intended travelling to Venice, where he would receive one part of his fortune, and then proceeding to Vienna, where he would find the rest. He meant to take up his residence in the latter town, which he had been told was the city of pleasure. He had scarcely advanced 3 leagues out of Rome when daylight began to disappear. Danglars had not intended starting so late, or he would have remained. He put his head out and asked the postillion how long it would be before they reached the next town.
"Non capisco," was the reply.
Danglars bent his head, which he meant to imply, "Very well." The carriage again moved on.
"I will stop at the first posting house," said Danglars to himself.
He still felt the same self-satisfaction which he had experienced the previous evening, and which had procured him so good a night's rest. He was luxuriously stretched in a good English caleche with double springs. He was drawn by 4 good horses at full gallop. He knew the relay to be at a distance of 7 leagues.
what subject of meditation could present itself to the banker so fortunately become bankrupt. Danglars thought for 10 minutes upon his wife in Paris, another 10 minutes upon his daughter travelling about with Mademoiselle d'Army. The same period was given to his creditors, and the manner in which he intended spending their money. And then, having no subject left for contemplation, he shut his eyes and fell asleep. Now and then, a jolt more violent than the rest caused him to open his eyes. Then he felt that he was still carried with vast rapidity over the same country, so thickly strewn with broken aqueducts, which looked like granite giants petrified in the midst of their course. But the night was cold, chill, and rainy, and it was much more pleasant for a traveller to remain in the warm carriage than to put his head out of the window to make inquiries of a postillion, whose only answer was, "Non capisco." Danglars therefore continued to sleep, saying to himself that he would be sure to awake at the posting-house. The carriage stopped. Danglars fancied they had reached the long-desired point. He opened his eyes, looked through the window, expecting to find himself in the midst of some town or at least village. But he saw nothing but a kind of ruin, whence 3 or 4 men went and came like shadows. Danglars waited for a moment, expecting the postillion to come and demand payment, having finished his stage. He intended taking advantage of the opportunity to make fresh inquiries of the new conductor, but the horses were unharnessed, and others were put in their places without anyone claiming money from the traveller. Danglars, astonished, opened the door, but a strong hand pushed him back and the carriage rolled on. The Baron was completely roused.
"Eh!" he said to the postillion. "Eh, mio caro!"
This was another little piece of Italian the Baron had learnt from hearing his daughter sing Italian duets with Cavalcanti. But mio caro replied not. Danglars then opened the window.
"Come, my friend," he said, thrusting his hand through the opening. "Where are we going?"
"Dentro la testa," answered a solemn and imperious voice, accompanied by a menacing gesture. Danglars thought "dentro la testa" meant "put in your head." He was making rapid progress in Italian. He obeyed, not without some uneasiness, which, momentarily increasing, caused his mind, instead of being as unoccupied as it was when he began his journey, to fill with ideas which were very likely to keep a traveller awake, more especially one in such a situation as Danglars. His eyes acquired that quality which, in the first moment of strong emotion, enables them to see distinctly, and which afterwards fails from being too much taxed. Before we are alarmed, we see correctly. When we are alarmed, we see double, and when we have been alarmed, we see nothing but trouble. Danglars observed a man in a cloak galloping at the right hand of the carriage.
"Some gendarme," he exclaimed. "Can I have been signalled by the French telegraphs to the pontifical authorities?"
He resolved to end his anxiety.
"Where are you leading me?" he asked.
"Dentro la testa," replied the same voice, with the same menacing accent. Danglars turned to the left. Another man on horseback was galloping on that side.
"Decidedly," said Danglars, with the perspiration on his forehead, "I must be taken."
And he threw himself back in the calèche, not this time to sleep, but to think. Directly afterwards, the moon rose. He then saw the great aqueducts, those stone phantoms which he had before remarked. Only then they were on the right hand, now they were on the left. He understood that they had described a circle and were bringing him back to Rome.
"Oh, unfortunate," he cried. "They must have obtained my arrest."
The carriage continued to roll on with frightful speed. A terrible hour elapsed, for every spot they passed indicated they were on the road back. At length he saw a dark mass, against which it seemed the carriage must dash. But it turned round, leaving behind it the mass, which was no other than one of the ramparts encircling Rome.
"Oh, oh," cried Danglars, "we are not returning to Rome. Then it is not justice which is pursuing me. Gracious heavens, another idea presents itself. What if they should be..."
His hair stood on end. He remembered those interesting stories so little believed in Paris, respecting Roman bandits. He remembered the adventures that Albert de Morcerf had related when it was intended he should marry Mademoiselle Eugénie.
"They are robbers, perhaps," he muttered.
Just then the carriage rolled on something harder than the gravelled road.
Danglar hazarded a look on both sides of the road and perceived monuments of a singular form, and his mind now recalled all the details Morcerf had related, and comparing them with his own situation, he felt sure he must be on the Appian Way. On the left, in a sort of valley, he perceived a circular excavation. It was Caracalla's circle. On a word from the man who rode at the side of the carriage, it stopped. At the same time, the door was opened.
"Scendi!" exclaimed a commanding voice.
Danglars instantly descended. Though he did not yet speak Italian, he understood it very well. More dead than alive, he looked around him. Four men surrounded him besides the postillion.
"Di qua,"
said one of the men, descending a little path leading out of the Appian Way. Danglars followed his guide without opposition, and had no occasion to turn round to see whether the three others were following him. Still, it appeared as though they stopped at equal distances from one another, like sentinels. After walking for about 10 minutes, during which Danglars did not exchange a single word with his guide, he found himself between a hillock and a clump of high weeds. Three men, standing silent, formed a triangle, of which he was the centre. He wished to speak, but his tongue refused to move.
"Avanti," said the same sharp and imperative voice.
This time Danglars had double reason to understand, for if the word and gesture had not explained the speaker's meaning, it was clearly expressed by the man walking behind him, who pushed him so rudely that he struck against the guide. This guide was our friend Peppino, who dashed into the thicket of high weeds through a path which none but lizards or polecats could have imagined to be an open road. Peppino stopped before a pit overhung with thick hedges. The pit, half open, afforded a passage to the young man, who disappeared like the evil spirits in the fairy tales. The voice and gesture of the man who followed Danglars ordered him to do the same. There was no longer any doubt. The bankrupt was in the hands of Roman banditti. Danglars acquitted himself like a man placed between two dangerous positions and who is rendered brave by fear. Notwithstanding his large stomach, certainly not intended to penetrate the fissures of an Italian road, he slid down like Peppino and, closing his eyes, fell upon his feet. As he touched the ground, he opened his eyes. The path was wide but dark. Peppino, who cared little for being recognized now he was in his own territories, struck a light and lit a torch. Two other men descended after Danglars, forming the rearguard, and pushing Danglars whenever he happened to stop, they arrived by a gentle declivity at the center of a crossroad of sinister appearance. Indeed, the walls, hollowed out in sepulchres, placed one above the other, seemed, in contrast with the white stones, to open their large dark eyes, like those which we see on the faces of the dead. A sentinel struck his carbine against his left hand. "Who goes there?" he cried. "Friends, friends," said Peppino. "But where is the captain?" "There," said the sentinel, pointing over his shoulder to a sort of large hall, hollowed out of the rock, the lights from which shone into the passage through the large arched openings. "Fine spoil, captain, fine spoil," said Peppino in Italian, and taking Danglars by the collar of his coat, he dragged him to an opening resembling a door, through which they entered the hall, of which the captain appeared to have made his dwelling place.
"Is this the man?" asked the captain, who was attentively reading Plutarch's Life of Alexander. "Himself, captain, himself." "Very well. Show him to me."
At this rather impertinent order, Peppino raised his torch to Danglars' face, who hastily withdrew that he might not have his eyelashes burnt. His agitated features presented the appearance of pale and hideous terror.
"The man is tired," said the captain. "Conduct him to his bed." "Oh," murmured Danglars, "that bed is probably one of the coffins hollowed in the wall, and the sleep I shall enjoy will be death from one of the poniards I see glistening in the shade."
From the depths of the hall were now seen to rise from their beds of dried leaves or calfskin the companions of the man who had been found by Albert de Morcerf reading Caesar's commentaries, and by Danglars studying the Life of Alexander. The banker uttered a groan and followed his guide. He neither supplicated nor exclaimed. He no longer possessed strength, will, power, or feeling. He followed where they led him. At length, he found himself at the foot of a staircase, and he mechanically lifted his foot 5 or 6 times. Then a low door was opened before him, and bending his head to avoid striking his forehead, he entered a small room cut out of the rock. The cell was clean, though naked, and dry, though situated at a great distance under the earth. Dangla, on beholding it, brightened, fancying it a type of safety.
"Oh, God be praised," he said. "It is a real bed."
"Echo," said the guide, and pushing Dangla into the cell, he closed the door upon him. A bolt grated. Dangla was a prisoner. Besides, had there been no bolt, it would have been impossible for him to pass through the midst of the garrison who held the catacombs of San Sebastián, encamped round a master whom our readers must have recognized as the famous Luigi Vampa. Dangla, too, had recognized the bandit, whose existence he would not believe when Albert de Morcerf mentioned him in Paris. And not only did he recognize him, but also the cell in which Albert had been confined, and which was probably kept for the accommodation of strangers. These recollections were dwelt upon with some pleasure by Dangla, and restored him to some degree of tranquillity. Since the bandits had not dispatched him at once, he felt that they would not kill him at all. They had arrested him for the purpose of robbery, and as he had only a few louis about him, he doubted not he would be ransomed. He remembered that Morcerf had been taxed at 4,000 crowns, and, as he considered himself of much greater importance than Morcerf, he fixed his own price at 8,000 crowns. 8,000 crowns amounted to 48,000 livres. He would then have about 5,050,000 francs. With this sum, he could manage to keep out of difficulties. Therefore, tolerably secure in being able to extricate himself from his position, provided he were not rated at the unreasonable sum of 5,050,000 francs, he stretched himself on his bed, and, after turning round 2 or 3 times, he fell asleep with the tranquillity of the hero whose life Luigi Vampa was studying. 115. Luigi Vampa's Bill of Fare. We awake from every sleep except the one dreaded by Dangla. He awoke. To a Parisian accustomed to silken curtains, walls hung with velvet drapery, and the soft perfume of burning wood, the white smoke of which diffuses itself in graceful curves around the room, the appearance of the whitewashed cell which greeted his eyes on awaking seemed like the continuation of some disagreeable dream. But in such a situation, a single moment suffices to change the strongest doubt into certainty. "Yes, yes," he murmured, "I am in the hands of the brigands of whom Albert de Morcerf spoke." His first idea was to breathe, that he might know whether he was wounded. He borrowed this from Don Quixote, the only book he had ever read, but which he still slightly remembered.
"No," he cried, "they have not wounded, but perhaps they have robbed me." And he thrust his hands into his pockets. They were untouched. The 100 louis he had reserved for his journey from Rome to Venice were in his trousers pocket, and in that of his greatcoat he found the little note-case containing the letter of credit for 5,050,000 francs. "Singular bandits," he exclaimed. "They have left me my purse and pocket-book. As I was saying last night, they intend me to be ransomed. Hola, here is my watch. Let me see what time it is."
Dangla's watch, one of Breguet's chef d'oeuvre, which he had carefully wound up on the previous night, struck 5:30. Without this, Dangla would have been quite ignorant of the time, for daylight did not reach his cell. Should he demand an explanation from the bandits, or should he wait patiently for them to propose it? The last alternative seemed the most prudent, so he waited until 12 o'clock. During all this time, a sentinel, who had been relieved at 8 o'clock, had been watching his door. Dangla suddenly felt a strong inclination to see the person who kept watch over him. He had remarked that a few rays, not of daylight but from a lamp, penetrated through the ill-joined planks of the door. He approached it just as a brigand was refreshing himself with a mouthful of brandy, which, owing to the leather bottle containing it, sent forth an odour which was extremely unpleasant to Dangla.
"Faugh!" he exclaimed, retreating to the extreme corner of his cell.
At 12, this man was replaced by another functionary, and Dangla, wishing to catch sight of his new guardian, approached the door again. He was an athletic, gigantic bandit with large eyes, thick lips, and a flat nose. His red hair fell in disheveled masses like snakes around his shoulders.
"Ah! Ah!" cried Dangla. "This fellow is more like an ogre than anything else. However, I am rather too old and tough to be very good eating."
We see that Dangla was quite collected enough to jest. At the same time, as though to disprove the ogreish propensities, the man took some black bread, cheese, and onions from his wallet, which he began devouring voraciously.
"May I be hanged," said Dangla, glancing at the bandit's dinner through the crevices of the door. "May I be hanged if I can understand how people can eat such filth."
And he withdrew to seat himself upon his goatskin, which recalled to him the smell of the brandy. But the secrets of nature are incomprehensible, and there are certain invitations contained in even the coarsest food which appeal very irresistibly to a fasting stomach. Dangla felt his own not to be very well supplied just then, and gradually the man appeared less ugly, the bread less black, and the cheese more fresh, while those dreadful vulgar onions recalled to his mind certain sauces and side dishes which his cook prepared in a very superior manner whenever he said,
"Monsieur Denisot, let me have a nice little fricassee today."
He rose and knocked at the door. The bandit raised his head. Dangla knew that he was heard, so he redoubled his blows.
"Que cosa?"
asked the bandit.
"Come, come," said Dangla, tapping his fingers against the door. "I think it is quite time to think of giving me something to eat."
But whether he did not understand him, or whether he had received no orders respecting the nourishment of Dangla, the giant, without answering, recommenced his dinner. Dangla felt his pride hurt, and not wishing to commit himself with the brute, threw himself down again on his goatskin and did not breathe another word. 4 hours passed by. The giant was replaced by another bandit. Dangla, who really began to experience sundry gnawings at the stomach, rose softly and again applied his eye to the crack of the door and recognized the intelligent countenance of his guide. It was indeed Peppino, who was preparing to mount guard as comfortably as possible by seating himself opposite to the door and placing between his legs an earthen pan containing chickpeas stewed with bacon. Near the pan he also placed a pretty little basket of grapes and a bottle of Vin d'Orvieto. Peppino was decidedly an epicure. While witnessing these preparations, Dangla's mouth watered.
"Come," he said to himself, "let me try if he will be more tractable than the other," and he tapped gently at the door.
"Coming," exclaimed Peppino, who, from frequenting the house of Maitre Pastrini, understood French perfectly. Dangla immediately recognized him as the man who had called out in such a furious manner, "Put in your head." But this was not the time for recrimination, so he assumed his most agreeable manner and said with a gracious smile,
"Excuse me, sir, but are they not going to give me any dinner?"
"Does your excellency happen to be hungry?"
"Happen to be hungry? That's excellent when I have not eaten for 24 hours, muttered Dangla.
Then he added aloud,
"Yes, sir, I am hungry, very hungry."
"What would your excellency like?" And Peppino placed his pan on the ground so that the steam rose directly under the nostrils of Dangla. "Give your orders."
"Have you kitchens here?"
"Kitchens? Of course, complete ones."
"And cooks?" "Excellent. Well, a fowl, fish, game, it signifies little, so that I eat."
"As your excellency pleases. You mentioned a fowl, I think."
"Yes, a fowl."
Peppino, turning round, shouted, "A fowl for his excellency." His voice yet echoed in the archway when a young man, handsome, graceful, and half-naked, appeared bearing a fowl in a silver dish on his head, without the assistance of his hands.
"I could almost believe myself at the Café de Paris," murmured Dangla.
"Here, your excellency," said Peppino, taking the fowl from the young bandit and placing it on the worm-eaten table which, with a stool and the goatskin bed, formed the entire furniture of the cell. Dangla asked for a knife and fork. "Here,"
Excellency, said Peppino, offering him a little blunt knife and a boxwood fork. Dangla took the knife in one hand and the fork in the other, and was about to cut up the fowl. Pardon me, Excellency, said Peppino, placing his hand on the banker's shoulder. People pay here before they eat. They might not be satisfied and... Ah, thought Dangla. This is no longer like Paris, without reckoning that I shall probably be fleeced. Never mind, I will carry it off well. I have always heard how cheap poultry is in Italy. I should think a fowl is worth about 12 sous at Rome. There, he said, throwing a louis down. Peppino picked up the louis, and Dangla again prepared to carve the fowl. Stay a moment, Your Excellency, said Peppino, rising. You still owe me something. I said they would fleece me, thought Dangla, but resolving to resist the extortion, he said, Come, how much do I owe you for this fowl? Your Excellency has given me a louis on account. A louis on account? For a fowl? Certainly. And Your Excellency now owes me 4,999 louis. Dangla opened his enormous eyes on hearing this gigantic joke. Come, come, this is very droll, very amusing, I allow. But as I am very hungry, pray allow me to eat. Stay, here is another louis for you. Then that will make only 4,998 louis, said Peppino, with the same indifference. I shall get them all in time. Oh, as for that, said Dangla, exasperated at his perseverance in the jest, as for that, you will never succeed. Go to the devil. You do not know with whom you have to deal. Peppino made a sign, and the youth hastily removed the fowl. Dangla threw himself upon his goatskin, and Peppino, reclosing the door, again began eating his peas and bacon. Though Dangla could not see Peppino, the noise of his teeth allowed no doubt as to his occupation. He was certainly eating, and noisily too, like an ill-bred man. Brute, said Dangla. Peppino pretended not to hear him, and, without even turning his head, continued to eat slowly. Dangla's stomach felt so empty, it seemed as though it would be impossible ever to fill it again. Still, he had patience for another half hour, which appeared to him like a century. He again rose and went to the door. Come, sir, do not keep me starving here any longer, but tell me what they want. Nay, Your Excellency, it is you who should tell us what you want. Give your orders, and we will execute them. Then open the door directly. Peppino obeyed. Pardieu, I want something to eat. To eat, do you hear? Are you hungry? Come, you understand me. What would Your Excellency like to eat? A piece of dry bread, since the fowls are beyond all price in this accursed place. Bread? Very well. Hello there. Some bread, he exclaimed. The youth brought a small loaf. How much? Asked Dangla. 4,998 louis, said Peppino. You have paid 2 louis in advance.
What? 100,000 francs for a loaf?
100,000 francs, repeated Peppino.
But you asked only 100,000 francs for a fowl.
We have a fixed price for all our provisions. It signifies nothing whether you eat much or little, whether you have 10 dishes or one. It is always the same price.
What? Still keeping up this silly jest? My dear fellow, it is perfectly ridiculous, stupid. You had better tell me at once that you intend starving me to death.
Oh, dear, no, Your Excellency, unless you intend to commit suicide. Pay and eat.
And what am I to pay with, brute? Said Dangla, enraged. Do you suppose I carry 100,000 francs in my pocket?
Your Excellency has 5,050,000 francs in your pocket. That will be 50 fowls at 100,000 francs apiece, and half a fowl for the 50,000. Dangla shuddered. The bandage fell from his eyes, and he understood the joke, which he did not think quite so stupid as he had done just before.
Come, he said, if I pay you the 100,000 francs, will you be satisfied and allow me to eat at my ease?
Certainly, said Peppino.
But how can I pay them?
Oh, nothing easier. You have an account opened with Messrs. Thompson and French, Via de Banchi, Rome. Give me a bill for 4,998 louis on these gentlemen, and our banker shall take it.
Dangra thought it as well to comply with a good grace, so he took the pen, ink, and paper Peppino offered him, wrote the bill, and signed it.
Here, he said, here is a bill at sight.
And here is your fowl. Dangla sighed while he carved the fowl. It appeared very thin for the price it had cost. As for Peppino, he read the paper attentively, put it in his pocket, and continued eating his peas. 116. The Pardon.